In this episode, we talk with Thomas P. Curran, author of Millionaire Legacy, and we focus on the success strategies of three aviators, Sean D. Tugger, Captain Julie Clark, and Captain Sully Sullenberger. In the news, we talk about ab initio pilot training from JetBlue, watching a solar eclipse from an airplane, a bill to curb airline fees, stricter oversight of pilot mental health, and high-altitude drone flying. All that and much more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 393 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me in the host chairs are, first off, aviation historian David Vanderhoof.
Hello, Max. Hello, everyone. Looking forward to a good episode today.
Also with us is Rob Mark. He's a pilot, a flight instructor, an aviation journalist, and publisher of the Jetwine blog.
Hi.
We told Rob to be quick and short. You know.
Was that short enough?
Perfect, Rob.
Hey, good evening to everybody.
Also with us is our associate producer, Brian Coleman. Hey, Brian.
Hi, Max and everyone, and happy Pi Day.
That's right. Today is Pi Day as we record this. Very exciting, I guess. also with us is the other Max, Max Trescott. He's a CFI, an author, and a glass cockpit expert. Sometimes we say Max West.
Hey, hello, co-hosts, and I'm just thinking someday we need a guest name, Max, just to make it really, you know, confusing.
That would be especially confusing.
Yeah. Three of us on here. Yeah,
exactly. What a disaster.
And I want to stand up for Rob here for a moment. No more short jokes, okay?
Okay. Till next time.
Yeah.
Our guest this episode is Thomas Curran. He's an author, a coach, a speaker, and a radio host. Tom's a certified trainer, and he uses advanced strategies to coach his students to attain their dreams and goals. Tom's developed training curriculums, performance evaluations, and he assists his clients with developing their strategic marketing plans. Tom's also a member of the EAA and AOPA, and he's written a book, Millionaire Legacy, which focuses on the eight success strategies that self-made millionaires use to acquire wealth and peace and contentment. Top leading business, motivational, and aviation leaders are included within his book, including some names that you all will recognize, Sean D. Tugger, Captain Julie Clark, and Captain Sully Sullenberger. These three aviators, of course, are highly regarded in the aviation community, and Tom's book outlines the steps they took in order to overcome challenges and reach a successful outcome. Tom, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Max, thank you for having me on the show. I'm looking forward to it.
We're really looking forward to the conversation we're going to have after the news, because while you do talk about, you know, a number of other successful people, it's going to be really fascinating, I think, to sort of focus in on these aviators and relate them to the points that you make more broadly in the book. So we're really looking forward to that conversation with Tom. All right. Well, first off, let's get started with the aviation news. So is everyone ready?
Ready.
Yeah.
Ready from the West.
Our first story comes from Time. This is JetBlue wants to train you to become a pilot. In episode 379, we discussed the plan by JetBlue called Gateway. At that time, the airline was proposing to the FAA a plan to hire potential commercial pilots and provide them with ab initio training. JetBlue wanted to start a trial for 100-seat Embraer SA-E190 pilots. Well, now we see that JetBlue has announced that they are taking applications for 24 Gateway Select program slots. 24 isn't a whole lot of positions, but I guess this sounds like it's good news. Rob, what do you think? There are some requirements, though, in order to get into this program.
Yeah, like the pilots are still going to pay for all the training. So I guess it's certainly a step in the right direction. But I think the only thing that kind of caught me was they're going to have them ready by the time they're done to jump into the right seat of a of an RJ or something. I just can't quite get the details on how they're going from low time to 1,500 hours. Max T, have you heard anything about that?
No, I don't know exactly how they're going to get from, oh, let's say the 250 hours that you might be when you have most of your licenses in hand, commercial, CFI, multi-engine, you know, things like that. Sounds to me like they perhaps might be using them as instructors to help build the time, but yeah, I really, really don't know. I have run into folks at you know, various places around the world who have ended up in the right seat of very large jets after, you know, under 300 hours. So I think it's possible, especially if the the training they get is, you know, oriented from day one toward airline operations. I mean, traditionally, folks that, you know, end up working for a regional jet after 1,500 hours, you know, don't have much, if any, orientation toward the airlines. A lot of their work is, you know, perhaps teaching or, you know, traffic watch or something like that. I did find it kind of interesting that airline unions said they didn't like the program. They thought JetBlue should instead hire pilots from regional airlines who are currently being passed over for jobs. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, aren't the regional airline guys moving up in droves? I mean, I don't know that they're getting passed over.
Yeah, that's kind of what we've been hearing. We've talked about regional airlines where that's been a big problem for them because of the fact that so many of the pilots are moving up to the majors.
Really dumb statement. If they're being passed over, do I really want them flying my airliner?
Well, of course, we want well-trained, well-qualified pilots. Rob mentioned the cost, or that the students would be carrying the cost. I guess this article says that it could be around $125,000. But it also points out that there may be an opportunity to defray some of those tuition costs by working on the side as an instructor for CAE. And CAE is the flight simulation or simulator manufacturer that's partnered with JetBlue in this training.
As an instructor, if they're charging $125,000, that's $3 million for the 24 candidates here. Do you think that they're actually making money by charging the $125,000, or do you think that that's just recovering some of their costs in doing this?
Boy, my wild guess is that they're going to need more than 24 people to break even. My guess is that you know, they're losing money you know, on the first 24 people, but when they get it up to, you know, 75 people or something like that, you know, they may be making money. I don't know what their break even point is, but I would imagine they've got a, you know, significant overhead in getting this thing started.
Well, in order to apply for this position or one of these positions, you have to be at least 23 years old. 23 years old by completion of the program. You have to have a high school degree. There are some application fees that you have to pay. And then in terms of the process, there's an online application. You have to write some essays. That's followed by some in-person tests and interviews. Part of the criteria, or the judgment, will be on personality and hand-eye coordination, multitasking, and critical thinking. Also notes that there's no psychological screening.
No, Max, we can still do it, buddy.
Yeah.
No, I'm worried. I don't think I'll be able to pass the swimsuit competition.
I don't think any of us would.
Oh, dear.
And then finally, it notes that the first six recruits are supposed to start training in late summer.
You know, there's one thing it doesn't mention here, and that's U.S. citizenship. And I'm not making a joke on, you know, natural born citizen and all that kind of stuff. The reality is that if you are a U.S. citizen, it's very easy to start flight training in the United States. If you're not, then you go through an application process, which takes multiple weeks and actually requires fingerprinting, background checked, and so on. So, you know, that would certainly be part and parcel of this as well.
Hmm. Moving on, next story. This is from the Orlando Sentinel. Alaska Airlines delayed a flight, Flight 870, from Anchorage to Honolulu. And they did that because then the plane's path would intersect with a total solar eclipse. The plane had a big group of eclipse chasers on board, and they captured the view, and I have to say, and the excitement in a video. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. But these guys kind of went crazy looking out the window at this solar eclipse.
Which just makes Alaska Airlines probably one of the coolest airlines around. I mean, what airline would, when contacted by a bunch of amateur astronomers, go, oh, sure, we'll hold up the flight. But Alaska, I thought, was really cool to have done this.
Yeah, it absolutely was fantastic that they did that.
And, you know, it mentions these eclipse chasers, and there really is a group. You know, once you've seen a total solar eclipse, you're really motivated to try to watch as many of these in person as you can. They're incredibly dramatic. A partial solar eclipse doesn't cut it. An annular solar eclipse, that's better, but it's nothing like seeing a total solar eclipse. And, you know, if you do have a little bit of...
You just said annual solar eclipse. Did we just lose our G rating?
No.
Not annular.
He said annular. Which is actually the only kind that I've seen, which it's cool, but not quite covers it completely. Yep.
So in this video, you can listen as these enthusiasts go nuts as they watch the shadow of the moon approach, and that really isn't a fascinating thing to see. But they also capture Bailey's beads and the diamond ring. And so if you know astronomy, you know exactly what those things are. I first saw those at an eclipse in March 1970, something I will absolutely never forget. There's actually going to be an eclipse next year that the path crosses the United States. Can learn more about that at eclipse2017.org. It shows you the path. It's kind of a diagonal path from Oregon to South Carolina. So if you're in that path, or if you can be on a plane intersecting that path, I'd really recommend it. All right, a different kind of an issue, maybe not so fun, airline fees. CNBC says airline fees are out of hand, a bill from senators says. And some senators are, I guess, fed up with the proliferation of airline fees. And so some legislators have introduced this bill. It's called the Fair Fees Act. It seems like all bills from the U.S. Congress have to have an acronym. So FAIR stands for Forbidding Airlines from Imposing Ridiculous Fees.
Yay.
How about a bill forbidding ridiculous, names for bills in Congress?
Or, yeah, spend less time picking an acronym and more time actually working on the bill.
Yeah, exactly.
The numbers are kind of large. I was going to say staggering, but, you know, on the scale of airlines, really, I mean, they're big numbers, but so are the airlines. So the numbers, the airlines collected $2.85 billion in bag fees in the first three quarters of 2015. They collected in the same time period $2.3 billion in change and cancellation fees. And these fees are going up. As we know, bag fees for all of 2014 were $3.5 billion. Back in 2007, they were only $464 million. So Senator Edward Markley of Massachusetts has said, quote, airlines should not be allowed to overcharge captive passengers just because they need to change their flight or have to check a couple of bags. So Markey is one of the authors of the bill. The other is, here he goes again, one of my Connecticut senators, Richard Blumenthal, is also one of the authors. I don't know. Do you think just because the numbers are big or they generate lots of profits for the airlines that makes them bad?
Well, it's lots of profit, as far as I know, outside of the tax of the ticket, right? Because when you price a ticket, there's a tax associated with that ticket value. These fees don't qualify. So it just gets recorded as income to the company. And then if the company makes money or not, they pay corporate tax on that. So I really think a lot of this is stemming from the fact that the government isn't collecting nearly as much tax as what they could.
You'd like to see, or you think they'd like to see taxes on the fees.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, did you guys catch the story on Ryanair this week that they are trying to win back customers? And part of the way that they're doing it is by actually reducing some of their fees. I just kind of wonder if, you know, this might happen naturally, you know, without an act of Congress. If, you know, if this just continued unabated and, you know, customers got really angry.
Well, I think that, you know, we've talked about the cyclical nature of the airline business. And while profits are high now, when you look over time, that, you know, they go up, they go down. And if you look at the long run, you know, it's a different kind of a picture. But it's kind of been on the plus side for an awful long time now. And, you know, when it first started swinging up, I think it was easy to say, yeah, the airlines deserve to try to recoup some of those billions of losses that they'd incurred previously. But the profits have just been rolling for a long time. But again, I think the key question is, or one of the key issues is, so what? You know, should the government get in and regulate that? The A4A?
Airlines for America?
Airlines for America, the industry trade group, they think that this is just an effort to re-regulate the airline industry.
Well, I think to re-regulate them, they'd have to start breaking them back up again. I mean, it's funny when you look over the long term, and airlines were deregulated, back in the late 1970s? And we must have had, 40 airlines in America, and now we seem to have about 10.
Yeah.
So it really does seem like things are becoming a little bit more monopolistic, and outrageous fees certainly might be one indication of that.
So, Tom, what do you think? Are they outrageous fees, do you think, or is it just airlines conducting business?
You have a fine line here between government versus private industry.
Mm-hmm.
And how much can government step in and make a determination about what the fees should be, to what amount? I mean, where does this go? And that would be my question to it. I'm not saying that some of the fees that these airlines charge don't get out of hand and they aren't astronomical, but at the same token, to what extent does government regulation come in and say, what do they make the determination on as far as what range that the airlines are allowed to charge?
Right, right. And I think in the bill that these two senators have proposed, I think the kind of language they use is fees that are in line. These are my words, not their words, but I'm paraphrasing. In line with the cost to provide the service. So if you're charging a bag fee, the fee should be commensurate with the cost to carry that additional bag. But it's not just the fees. I mean, we've seen recently also attempts to set minimum standards for seat size on commercial airlines. And Senator Chuck Schumer from New York said that he was going to offer an amendment to the FAA reauthorization bill that would require seat size standards. So, if passengers are upset about the amount of space they have or upset about the fees that they have and the airlines don't respond in some way, then, the legislators are going to take some action, whether it's ill-advised or well-advised.
I'm all for stopping seat pitch shrink. But that's because I'm 6'4".
Yeah, you've got a vested interest in that.
I have a vested interest in that, so yes. For once, I agree with Chuck Schumer, and I think hell's going to freeze over.
Well, but it's not only seat pitch, it's seat width as well.
Right.
Right. United's looking at the new 777 and putting 10 across seats, and how they're doing that, they're going with a 17-inch wide seat. Mm. With the largening of America, I'm not sure if that's such a great idea.
I took the 150-pound decrease route, so I'm good with that.
You changed your width, didn't you, David? But your height still remains.
I still got the legs.
But don't you think that's the last frontier for fees? I mean, when do you think they're going to start the poundage fee? A regular ticket is $150 unless you weigh over a certain poundage.
Yeah,
but that's already been done. They were doing that in what, Fiji or
Fiji.
If you can't fit in a seat, I don't think it's fair that you get charged for two seats, but I don't know.
David, being on several flights where the person spilled over into my space, I kind of think that they should have to buy two seats or at least have a seat that can accommodate them without them infringing upon my space.
You do when that person sort of made it over to your side of the seat? Brian,
there was one flight where I actually complained to the flight attendant and brought up to their attention that this other person of size had to fit in the seat. And fortunately, there was another seat for them to be reaccommodated. So they actually moved them from me. But yeah, I would have raised a much larger stink if they didn't do something like that.
I can't wait till first class and business class starts dramatically shrinking because they can't do any more in steerage. Wait till that uproar occurs.
Rob, do you remember what happened or what I did when I had that situation where the passenger next to me was sort of spilling over into my seat?
No, remind me.
We put up the armrest, and I used her thigh as an armrest, and we were both happy.
Oh, my gosh.
True story.
Really?
True story.
And you said her thigh.
No, no, no. I'm not doing that stuff.
Okay.
Wow. We really are trying to lose our G rating tonight, guys. No.
But, you know, when you talk about fees commensurate with the amount of service provided, look at, say, I lost 3 tickets last year, one on each of the majors, American, United, and Delta, because the tickets were cheap. And when something changed, I called them and they said, well, first of all, there's a $200 change fee. Now, let's see what the fare is today. Oh, well, there you go. It's, $448. So you still have to pay that. And I can book that for you in about 20 seconds. And so, come on, give me a break. That fee is so not even remotely commensurate with the service that the res agent has to perform. It's probably right up there with the baggage fee, I think.
Hey, it's $300 on an international ticket. So Jeez. Be grateful. Yeah. Yeah. So be grateful you're only flying domestically.
Wow.
Hey, Rob, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
I agree with you or agree with the point here that these fees are getting out of hand by the airlines. But at the same token, to what extent does government come in and start regulating? Are they going to start regulating every single aspect of what the amount should be? I mean, I agree with the one point. In some regards, they are out of hand. It's ridiculous. But at the other hand, when you start allowing the government to come in and start regulating it, that can open up a whole nother issue.
Well, you're right. It probably can. But I think as a consumer, what's our alternative? The airline story is, you don't like it? Go somewhere else. And that's not much of an option. And the airlines don't listen. Maybe it's not the government. I'd say let's come up with some neutral travel-oriented organization or something. To me, it doesn't have to be the government. But when they all kind of get together and charge the same thing, in the old days, that used to be called collusion, and you couldn't do that. But here, I guess nobody seems to care.
Well, in the old days, you had a lot more airlines to choose from.
True.
I mean, and now you do not have that now. In the old days, you had TWA, you had Eastern, a list continues on that are no longer in existence.
Well, here's the good news about all the high profits they're making. We're not having to bail out the airlines anymore, at least, you know, for the time being.
Yeah. And they're obviously ordering lots of airplanes.
So really what everyone's saying is we need to pretend the airlines are Bell Telephone and break them up.
Well, I don't know.
Could happen. I mean, if they do any more consolidation, absolutely.
Yeah, I think consolidation is about run its course. But if they act, monopolistic, if the consumer is damaged or disadvantaged as a result of the actions they take, bag fees, whatever. Yeah, then the government's going to step in and do something. It's kind of like we see this happen over and over again, that if your customers are not happy and you don't do something, then someone may come in and do it for you and you may not like what they do.
Well, and there is a DOJ investigation that started up, last summer, investigating whether the airlines are colluding in any way to keep ticket prices high. We've heard nothing about that, and my guess is that it's pretty hard to actually find hard evidence of something like that.
Well, why don't we move on to another item? We see the French BEA has issued some interesting things regarding the German Wings Airbus A320 crash. Now, you'll recall this is from March of last year, 2015, just about 1 year ago. where the pilot flew the A320 into the ground, killing all 150 people on board. And what happened was the captain left for a break. The other pilot locked the cockpit door and then set the plane to an altitude of 100 feet, which was below the altitude of the terrain that it was approaching. There have been reports, many reports in the press about the mental health of this particular pilot, and the BEA proposed rules for situations when pilots suffer from medical conditions that might pose a public risk. Now, this is kind of a balancing act between privacy law and the right of the public to expect a safe situation. This is just a proposal. It's not something that's mandated, so other action would have to take place. But it really views the relationship between a pilot, let's say, and their doctor, and the doctor and the airline. Max T., what do you think?
Boy, it's certainly something we ought to be looking at. I mean, I think all of us are in favor of privacy, but it's ridiculous to have somebody out there in the system who's who's dangerous, not just to themselves, but to the the people that they're trying to serve. So, yeah, I would say there's merit to coming up with a rule that does allow doctors to break confidentiality rules in this particular case. I think I would probably be in favor of that. I was just thinking there was just one time in all the years I've been giving flight instruction where I remember thinking, wow, the guy in the left seat is so angry that, if he decides to kill us right now, there might not be anything I can do about it. So there are a very tiny percentage of people running around like this who are, dangerous to themselves, but also to the public. So, yeah, we ought to be looking at it.
Well, and being the one who's married to the shrink in the group, we've had this conversation a number of times. My wife and I. But, and Nance has told me that in not just this aviation-focused situation, but in other personal relationships, the shrink is essentially banned from telling anybody unless they have made sort of an overt threat to themselves or someone else. So if I just say essentially that I think Max T's a big dummy, boy, and one of these days I'm going to get him, that's probably not considered enough of a threat that a psychologist who is treating me is going to turn me in and be able to cover their butt. Now, of course, if I make the threat more overt that I'm going over there right after I leave here and I pull a 45 out of my jacket, another story. But the other issue that we have to think about in terms of the one in Europe is that they already have a much more stringent privacy guidelines than we have here in the States. And that's a little frightening, but they're still stuck in the same place because the physician that might have been treating this guy did not necessarily know that he was a pilot. I mean, because you could go into a shrink and you don't have to tell him you're a pilot flying for an airline and that you're having emotional issues that you need medication for. There's no reason in the world they have to tell him that. And so that's where this is going to turn into a real quagmire. But then there's another one for you, Tom. But does the government jump in and try and fix this? Or even could they fix it?
That's the question. That's a good one. But I think the ultimate concern now in this manner is when you're talking an individual that has the responsibility of several hundred lives in his hand, what is the greater good here? Does his privacy override the safety of a couple hundred people on board that commercial airline? Or which is the most important issue here? Or saving the people on board the flight? And in that particular case, when you weigh the two, you would have to say at that point, there is no privacy as far as him posing a major threat or a major danger to possibly killing several hundred people on board a commercial airline flight.
You're right. And that, of course, begs the question, did the primary care physician even know the guy was a pilot? I mean, we don't know that for a fact yet.
Hmm. Well, one of the things that the BEA, it would seem, considered is the issue that at least the French pilot union has, which is that if a pilot stands to lose his job, because of the medical help that he might seek and the results of that, that maybe they won't go for treatment. And the BEA talked about this concept of a license loss insurance, so that if you do have some kind of a problem, you seek medical assistance. It turns out that in the opinion of the medical professional, you're not qualified or you should not be allowed to fly an airplane, that you're insured against losing your job as a result of this or not being able to work for some period of time, because otherwise people, again, just might be afraid to seek help for fear that they might lose their job.
And this is actually just kind of a modern-day version of something that came up back in the mid-1970s. I recall that the same issue faced pilots who had alcohol problems. And, of course, they were very reluctant to share with their airline management or anybody else that they might have a drinking problem. And so they came up with a program which basically said, if you're a pilot and you're an alcoholic, we will let you keep your job as long as you start going into a treatment program. And I still remember in the mid-1970s meeting a gentleman who we'll call Gus, because actually that was his first name, who was, and I'm sure he's long since passed away. But he was an awesome guy. I mean, I really, really, really enjoyed getting to know him. And he was very grateful that he was allowed to go through one of these programs and was allowed to continue to fly. So I think that is definitely the right approach.
All right. Well, let's see. We have some, I guess this is kind of breaking news. FAA reauthorization bill passes the House. Max T., did you pick up on this one?
I did. I saw that this afternoon while I was grabbing a late lunch. And this is something we've talked about, and I think we all pretty much expected. Max, I think you've pretty much said you thought this was going to happen. Of course, it's not through both of the houses, of Congress here. It's just through our House, not through the Senate. But it's a reauthorization bill just to keep the money flowing for a few more months while the various committees try and come up with a bill that addresses some of the deeper issues that we've been talking about. And kind of related to that, interestingly, I saw that Representative Schuster from the House Transportation Committee had said, "Our work is not done." And by that, I think he meant that he's still trying to figure out a formula for putting together a long-term bill that would pass ATC privatization. So pilots out there, our work is also still not yet done. Yeah. If you haven't written your congressmen yet, now's a good time to go ahead and kind of let them know, because I think the cooks are still stirring the pot in the back, and they're looking to bring this out another time. But in the meantime, the FAA isn't being held hostage, and presumably the Senate will go along with this, and there'll be more funding to keep the doors open.
All right. Final news story. You have to have at least one idiot in the news, right? So this comes from petapixel.com.
Who's our idiot this week, Max?
Well, it's some guy in the Netherlands who took his DJI Phantom, and I guess, David, is this right? He was trying to set a world altitude record for a quadcopter or something like that?
Yeah, that was what was behind it, and we talked about this last week on UAV Digest. He proceeded to fly it to 11,000 feet and then got in trouble because he broadcast it and broke a record. And then the feds wanted to know why he was flying his quadcopter at 11,000 feet.
Yeah, he put a video up on YouTube, but that was taken down.
Well, the funny thing is, the Netherlands, where is that located? Well, kind of right where all of the airline paths cross among all the different countries in Europe. I mean, the air traffic there has got to be about as dense as any part of Europe. And 11,000 feet, I mean, it just boggles the mind that anybody would think that was a reasonable thing to try and do. But maybe we've got this new culture, which is everybody wants to be a star. Everybody wants to set a record. Everybody wants to have some bragging rights. But holy cow, I mean, this you kind of almost wish that this guy had run out of battery and had fallen down and hit him on the head and he won a Darwin Award instead.
So Max, David, is it true that you guys are going to have him on the UAV Digest this week?
No, because we don't condone that kind of behavior on the UAV Digest. Much like we don't allow dronophobes like yourself on the UAV Digest. You have to find a happy balance.
Rob is converted, by the way. He's
not completely.
Oh, no, sure, Rob. Didn't you hear about the prize money in the drone race over in the UK this last couple days?
In Dubai.
Yeah.
You don't know how much?
No.
God, guys, tell them.
$1 million.
Whoa.
Real money for FPV drone racing these days.
Yep.
Does that Amazon Prime, that'll deliver a drone overnight, won't it?
Start practicing. All right, we're talking with the author of Millionaire Legacy, Thomas Curran. Tom, I know that most of our listeners are going to be pretty familiar with the three aviators that you talk about in your book, but let's talk about those three first before we talk generally about the book, and maybe start with Sean Tucker. We all know he's a fantastic aerobatic pilot. He flies the Oracle Challenger 3 biplane, and I think that even is on the cover of your book, isn't it, Tom?
Actually, yes. It's a sketch image of his airplane.
He started out with a fear of flying, did he? How did he overcome that?
Well, Max, a lot of people aren't aware of this. And this is actually one of my reasons for the book, is to share the real story behind Sean, behind Julie Clark, and Captain Sully. But many years ago, Sean actually watched one of his close friends die in a skydiving accident. After that, he developed a very deep fear of flying. And when he would sit at the controls of the airplane, he would have a panic attack. He would actually panic. And at this point, he had a decision to make. He could either walk away from his passion or he could embrace it directly. There was a woman many years ago. Her name was Amelia Reed. I don't know if any of you familiar with her from San Jose, California?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, the airport in San Jose is named after her grandfather, I believe, who started it.
Yes, the Reed Hillview Airport, actually. But yeah, she was a flight instructor, air show performer. Well, Sean Tucker went to her. He reached out to her. And Sean explained to Amelia what his fear was, what his concern was. She told him not to worry about it. She took him up for an aerobatic flight. And after this aerobatic flight, Sean fell in love with aerobatics. And at that point, he was able to release all of his anxiety and his fear disappeared. And I think that the key thing with it is that he had such a strong passion to become a pilot, to become an aerobatic pilot, that he would not allow the fear, it was a real fear that he had, to start having a panic attack at the controls of the airplane, not being able to fly, to be able to overcome that because he wanted to reach his greater passion of becoming an aerobatic pilot, which is absolutely amazing.
Hey, we have to mention one thing about Amelia Reed, though. Do you know what kind of airplane that she used to do her air show aerobatics demonstrations in?
I'm not sure on that one.
A Cessna 150 Aerobat. I mean, she was absolutely famous for, flying at weird angles down the runway in what most people would consider a spectacularly underpowered airplane for aerobatics. But that's one of the things that she was known for locally.
Interesting. Yeah, Tom, I can really identify with that kind of a fear. I mean, a number of years ago, I had an accident on the highway not too far from here where somebody tagged me from the back, and it turned into a rollover kind of experience. Where the witnesses described what they saw as my truck tumbling down the highway, and I was okay. For a long time, when I drove through that stretch of highway, it didn't quite rise to the level of panic attack, but it was awfully close. I mean, I got nervous. I was sweating, and there's no reason really to be afraid of that stretch of road. As soon as I was through there, I was fine. But that kind of a fear can be really debilitating. And also, I mean, just fear in general like that, fear of failure or fear that you're not going to attain your dream of becoming a pilot or whatever it is, it can really hold you back.
The sad thing about it, Max, is that fear has held so many people back, countless people that have had their dreams, their passions to reach whatever goals they wanted to reach. And they've allowed fear to hold them back, and they never went after their true dreams and goals. And that's very sad.
Yeah, and I think for a number of our listeners, some of those dreams and goals are things like becoming a pilot, flying for the airlines, worrying about how are they going to be able to afford the cost to reach that goal, things like that. And as a result, sometimes people just, you know, they don't take action.
Exactly. And that was one of my main things, Max. A lot of people look at Sean D. Tucker, very highly respected. Sean is an amazing individual. He really loves what he's doing. He loves the spectators. He loves flying. And I mean, he's phenomenal as the chairman of the EAA Young Eagles program because he loves giving back to children and to teenagers. And a lot of people look at him and they look at his great accomplishments, but they don't realize what he had to overcome in order to make it to where he's at today. And that was one of the reasons in my book that I wanted to share this story with the reader and share the story with the public that a lot of people are not aware of. They look at Sean, they see a very accomplished aerobatic pilot, very successful aerobatic pilot, and they don't realize what he had to go through in order to reach to that level of success that he's been able to accomplish.
Another example you talk about is Captain Julie Clark, who also had some adversity, but of really a completely different type.
Julie, another an amazing individual. She was definitely truly a pioneer for all women yes. within the field of aviation. Emily Warner was one of the very first captains. She worked for Frontier Airlines and became a commercial airline captain. Julie became a captain. And this was a time, Max, when women were flight attendants, or back then the word for it was stewardess. And they were not in the cockpit. They were not flying airplanes. To have these amazing women like Emily Warner, Captain Julie Clark, to be able to persevere and go after their dream, they opened the door for all women in the field of aviation. And Julie encountered a lot of hardship, a lot of hardship. She lost her mom when she was very young. Her mom actually died from choking. Then her father was actually a captain with Pacific Airlines. He was on a flight. A gunman pushed his way into the cockpit, shot Captain Ernie Clark to death, and subsequently the plane ended up crashing and all crew and passengers were killed. So Julie endured the loss of both of her parents, which is a tragedy for any young girl to have to endure. But she had a passion to fly. She had a passion to become a pilot, and she persisted. And Max, it wasn't easy. It was amazing talking to Julie Clark. She would start her day. She was so dedicated to reaching her dream. Her day would start at 6 o'clock in the morning and it would end at 2 in the morning. And then she would get up the next day and she would do the same thing. She would start the morning off by taking flying lessons at San Carlos Airport in California. Then she would head over to a Marine World and would go to her water skiing job. Then in the evening, she would go to the Charlie Brown Steakhouse and work as a waitress. And it just shows the true perseverance and dedication that she had because she needed to come up with the money to pay for the flight training. And the other interesting thing about her, as she was going through this, she started her own business. And a lot of people don't know about this. It was called Jules Clocks. And she would buy clocks and she would restore them and then sell them. And this allowed her to finance her advanced ratings. I mean, her dedication, her perseverance, absolutely amazing.
And she had some difficulty with some of, she had several husbands, correct? I recall from reading in your book, and there were some issues, some problems with some of them as well.
Well, she had some problems with her husbands, but she also had a problem with a treasurer who was working for her aerobatic business. She got a check for $70,000 and the treasurer deposited it into her bank account. And then he wrote him a check for the $70,000 and that money disappeared.
He wrote himself the check, right?
He wrote himself the check. Yes. Yeah. And that was money that she needed for her business. You know, another challenge that she had to overcome. And the other thing about it too, is she also had a problem several years ago. There were air combat schools out there. And they were flying to T-34s, which is the plane that Julie flies. And there was a crash of them. So what the FAA did is the FAA came in, Federal Aviation Administration came in, and they grounded all T-34s, just a blanket statement. Well, at that time, this meant that Julie could not perform her aerobatic routines in her T-34 because they were all grounded. But the Perseverance, I'm telling you, with Julie, there's nothing that's going to stop her. She actually flew out to Washington, D.C. at the time. She met with Jane Garvey, who was the head of FAA, and she pleaded her case. And she was able to get a waiver to fly her Beechcraft T-34 airplane. And I'll tell you what, Max, that is actually what saved her. That saved her business. If it wasn't for that waiver, her aerobatic career probably would have been over. Her aerobatic business probably would have been gone. And, you know, just another further element here of just like the dedication, the perseverance, being thrown challenges, obstacles in her path and not giving up and persisting.
As I was reading some of those challenges, what came into my head was that song by Chumbawamba. You know, I get knocked down, but I get up again. You're never going to keep me down. And that was, you know, it's sort of one adversity after another for you know, poor Julie Clark. And that song starts playing in my head. You know, the point is that time after time after time, something really out of her control happened that just threw a huge roadblock in front of her in terms of her being able to achieve what she was trying to achieve. And she just kept going. She just kept getting up again.
Max, I think you're 100% correct. That's why it's so important for me to include her in the book. And again, share her story. A lot of people do not know this. They look at Julie Clark. Okay, she's retired captain from Northwest Airlines. She's an aerobatic pilot. I know next month she's going to be down at Sun and Fun down in Florida. She's going to be at AirVenture this summer. But they don't really realize, they don't know the real Julie Clark. They have no idea what she went through in order to reach the level of success that she has today.
Hey, there's one fun story I have to share with you really quickly. I know Julie. We're lucky that you know, she lives close by here in Northern California. So her her father unfortunately died in the you know, the murder crash back in 1964. Prior to that, when she was a young girl, his dad would sneak her onto the DC-3s, and he would hide her in the baggage compartment. Can you believe that?
Wow.
So she and I remember seeing a picture of her, you know, kind of head sticking out or whatever. But, you know, it just tells me how you know, how much she really thought of her dad and aviation. Great story. And I think, you know, nobody would ever be able to get away with, you know, that these days. But, you know, that's kind of the fun stuff they were able to do back in the early 60s.
Okay, and Max, you Max T, if you're going to say that, you need to tell people where the baggage compartment on a DC-3 is. Everybody's thinking the poor woman was carried in the bay underneath the cockpit.
And I'm starting to wonder if it was a DC-3 because I know the type her dad was killed in was a Fairchild F-27A. But my recollection is the baggage was essentially in back of the passenger compartment at the same level.
Okay, just so people who don't understand that there are airplanes that didn't have baggage compartments, the baggage compartments were in the back of the airplane and not underneath where we store our stuff now.
Yeah, we weren't talking about pressurized airplanes going up into the flight levels either.
Hmm. Well, I think it's just amazing that someone who has that passion for aviation but then loses her father, forget all the other things, but loses her father in such a horrible way, that she was so driven that she didn't let that stop her. Tom, you also talk about Sully in the book. Why is Sully in your book?
Sully is another amazing individual. Everybody knows. I mean, or majority of people know, knows the story of U.S. Airways Flight 1549. That was back on January 15, 2009. Departed from LaGuardia Airport. Just after takeoff, they struck a flock of Canadian geese. And both engines were lost. And at this point, there was a lot that had to be done in order to save all the passengers and crew members on board that plane. And again, everyone, Max, focuses, all the news stories focus that Captain Sully was a hero. And yes, definitely a hero for saving everyone. But the key thing about it is, how was he able to do that? And the news stories all looked at his flight training. He was actually a former United States Air Force fighter pilot. He had many years of flight training. And that was all very positive elements. However, he was never trained at that time. In the simulators, they were never trained for a water landing. He was never trained for it. The only training that Captain Sully had in reference to doing a water landing was a theoretical classroom discussion. So, I mean, this was something that was that you could not train for. Your experience would come into play and would be beneficial, but it's something that you could not train for. But the interesting thing, as all of this stuff is going on with Captain Sully, they're starting to lose forward thrust. The plane now is slowly starting to descend, and he's got to make some fast decisions. He's unable to make it back to any airport. They were going to try to get him back to LaGuardia, couldn't do that. They were going to try to get him over to Teterboro in New Jersey, couldn't do that. So Sully made the decision to land the plane on the Hudson River. And another factor that a lot of people don't talk about, it wasn't just a matter of saving the passengers and crew members. It was also a matter of saving all of the people on the ground, because that was a very populated area. That issue isn't really talked about too much, but that was another factor, another issue that went into Captain Sully, as he's dealing actually with seconds, literally seconds, when this happened.
That's an awful lot to process in a very short period of time.
The thing about it is, we're all human. Captain Sully's human. We're all human. And we all face fear. And the thing about it is, trying to decide what you're going to do with a major commercial airline when you've lost both engines, you can't get it back to the airport, and how are you going to land it? And then attempting to land it on the Hudson River, you know, brings up a lot of fear. But what Sully was able to do is he was able to take his fear and he was able to place it to the side. He still had fear, and I'm sure he had a lot of anxiety, but he was able to take that fear, put it to the side, and he was able to focus on safely landing the plane on the Hudson River. And I think that is the one thing with Sully. Everyone focuses on the fact, okay, he did a great thing. His flight training came into play. He saved everyone on board the plane. But the other thing about it is he was able to take that fear. He did not allow himself to become paralyzed by fear. And he focused on the most important task, and that was safely landing the plane on the Hudson River and saving all passengers and crew members, and also people on the ground.
So, Tom, it's one thing for someone to say, oh, just put your fear aside. But what's an actionable item or two that a mere mortal like us might be able to do to help accomplish that task of not being paralyzed by fear?
Well, the problem with it, a lot of people, Brian, have given into fear and have reached some consequences that aren't very good. We're all human. We all experience fear. We all experience anxiety. But I think one of the things, and I think Captain Sully is a great example of it, is that when fear comes up, when fear rises to our conscious level and we're starting to experience it, I think the most important thing that we need to do is to focus on the ultimate objective, focus on the ultimate outcome, and don't feed into fear. Whatever you focus on will become enhanced. So in this particular situation with Sully, if he would have allowed himself to start focusing on the fear, how am I going to land this plane? How am I going to save everyone? If he would have allowed himself to start focusing on all of that fear, he would not have been able to land the plane safely on the Hudson River, which is what he did. And I think that's the key thing. When fear arises, we are all going to have fear, but we cannot feed into it. When you feed into it, when you enhance it, it's going to become over-magnified. You need to focus on the ultimate objective of what you want to accomplish, because that's when you can think clearly. That's when you can think with a clear focus and do what needs to be done to reach your ultimate objective. And then when it's all said and done, when it's all over, you can go back, and if you want to panic after
then
it's
you can.
Said, then you can go back at the end.
Yeah. I wanted to ask Rob something. This conversation is making me think of, Rob, other aviation accidents where you hear the air traffic control conversations, and it's always, well, not always, but it's oftentimes very remarkable how calm everybody is, even though the situation might be really bad.
Well, I'm probably going to get my head handed to me for this one. But you know what? I completely agree with what Sully did that day. But I think that unless you have been flying for a long time, you wouldn't understand the thought process behind what they were doing. I mean, I've come out of that same runway at LaGuardia a number of times, turn to the west, and you're crossing the Hudson. And boy, when both engines quit, if that were to happen, it is so clear that you ain't going down in the buildings. There is nowhere else to go. So you might as well focus on the river. And if you go back and listen to their conversation, they talked about Teterboro for a brief minute, and he said, no, we're going to the Hudson. You know, and there was, because there was no other choice. And that is what I don't understand how our brain works, but it's what a lot of pilots do. They compartmentalize the situation to find the solution. Look at what happened with United 232 when they lost all the hydraulics, and Al Haynes and his crew did something that every engineer had up until that point said was impossible. You know, controlling a 350 or 400,000 pound airplane with just differential thrust. But at that point, there was nothing else they could do. And I think when we talk about, you know, overcoming fear, the fear is, I ain't going to die. I'm not going to just sit here and let it take me. I may fight this airplane all the way to the ground, but the alternative is to do nothing, and that I could never live with. But and again, I don't know how they teach us that, but that's the way we all think. Some are not always as successful as Al Haynes was or as Sully was and a few others. But if I were talking to a new pilot today, I don't know how I would tell them that that's the way your brain needs to work, and that if you're any good, that's how it's going to work. But it sounds like magic, but, you know, and again, I'm not trying to minimize what they did. I'm just saying it is so clear at the time that it happens that it's either this or that. You know, if you told somebody that later, they'd say, oh, well, there must have been more to it. No, there really isn't, because you see the solutions come across that quickly in front of your eyes.
Hmm. Rob, I have a point to make on that. There are so many pilots, and we could take pilots that even have more experience than Sully. However, I mean, there's pilots that would have been the exact same situation, Rob, that would have become paralyzed by fear. And that fear would have become so immense that they would have ended up crashing the plane.
Well, maybe. And if it depends on, well, I don't know. I think I'd take exception with that. I think it would depend on the experience level. I mean, if you had somebody in a small airplane out over the Hudson and they lost the engine, I very, very possibly. And let's also not forget that they had absolute incredible luck that day, because if the weather had been bad, if the clouds had been low and they hadn't been able to see the Hudson, it would have been a whole different story, no matter what their experience level was. But I don't know. I maybe listeners have an opinion. I tend to think there aren't a whole lot of pilots that are flying for a living, that have been doing it professionally for a long time, that would have just panicked. I don't know. Max, what do you think?
Yeah, no, I think that if you were to put, you know, probably 100 pilots in the same situation, not having known the story in advance, yeah, I bet, you know, two-thirds, three-quarters of them would go, hey, there's the river, let's go for it. And frankly, all pilots have practice with, engine out, situations. Of course, they don't usually do it in airliners with zero engines, but they've done it years before.
And I'm not trying to minimize that either. I mean,
well, and Rob, to me, part of it, and Nancy could certainly educate us all on this, it's overcoming functional fixedness. So functional fixedness is when you assume or you think that one thing can only be used for that one thing. And no one really thinks of landing a plane in a river, whereas he had the thought of, hey, let's put the plane down in the river, and it worked. Now, if other pilots would have been successful in landing it, that's different.
Yeah, and I think the point isn't really so much to glorify Sully, but to use that as an example of you really can accomplish, and not just maybe not just Sully, but maybe a lot of people, but you can accomplish what you need to if you do certain things or if you don't do other things. One of the things you don't want to do is let the fear of the situation consume you so that you're not effective at that problem solving. Sully was good, as are many other pilots, at eliminating that fear, you know, putting that out of his mind, or maybe never letting it enter. I'm not sure. But so he can focus on the task, on the objectives he's trying to reach. And so for all of us in general, I think the point that Tom is making is that that's something that you can emulate if you find yourself in that situation, or if you want to be successful, or if you find yourself not being successful in reaching your objectives because of some kind of fear that you have. I mean, isn't that kind of what you're trying to say, Tom?
That's exactly what I'm trying to say. That is the whole key thing. We can argue the point that if we want to look statistically, that probably a majority of pilots would have viewed the Hudson River as a viable option. But there's still going to be some of them that would have given into that fear. There's going to be some of them that maybe would have used poor judgment, and they're so focused and they've got the tunnel vision. Oh, we've got to go land this on a runway. We're going to try to make this back to Teterboro, even though that was impossible. But because of their tunnel vision, we got to make this back to Teterboro, and they would have never made it. Hmm. And I think there's a number of issues that come into play here. But I think the most important thing with Sully is the fact that he did experience fear. The fear did come in, but he didn't allow that to paralyze him. And when he was able to put that to the side, then he was able to use his extensive flight training, his experience with the Air Force, his experience as a experienced pilot. And he was able to effectively use that so he could safely land the plane on the Hudson River and save all passengers and crew members. And of course, everyone, all the people on the ground too.
Well, let's see if we can do this. Let's see if we can tie together the themes between Sean Tucker and Julie Clark and Captain Sully. I mean, there are obviously a number of other impressive people that you talk about in the book. But is there a way to kind of wrap those three aviators together in some way and make some points that might be valuable for all of us?
I think the key thing here, Max, is they have a shared mindset. And this is a mindset that we can all have. If we don't have it, we can develop it. But a shared mindset. And what I mean by that is it's a mindset that no matter what obstacle is thrown into our path, whatever challenge we encounter, even though we may face fear, even though we may face failure countless times, we never give up. And we keep focused on our ultimate goal. We keep focused on our ultimate dream. It's the mindset of reaching that ultimate dream, of reaching that ultimate goal, no matter what. Even if you get knocked down, even if you experience fear, even if you experience challenges, even if you experience failure, you're not going to give up. You're going to keep getting back up, and you're going to keep pushing forward with your mind centered and focused on the ultimate goal, on the ultimate dream. And it is that mindset that I think really establishes Julie, Sean, Captain Sully, that really makes them stand at the top. By sharing their stories, I want to help people. I want to help the reader. And I want everyone to know that we can all get that mindset. We can all have that type of mindset. There have been so many people, Max, that have given up on their dreams. There have been so many people that have given up on their goals in life. And it's sad. And they've walked away from it. And they could have done maybe great things. Maybe some people would have become very well known that we'll never know about. But they gave up on them. When things got rough, they turned around and they just gave up. And that's very sad. But the thing about Sean, Julie, and Sully, they had major obstacles. They had major challenges. But they persevered. They kept their dedication. And they reached a very successful outcome.
But why? Why are, you know, those folks that you mentioned, Tom, that, you know, never got to their dream and they turned around and walked away, and then you have the Seans and the Sullys and the Julies. How do they get that mindset?
I think the mindset, Rob, comes back to this. We all have passions and we all have dreams deep within our heart and our soul, whatever they may be. And I think when you really want something very bad, that you have to realize that anything in life, you know, there's going to be challenges, of course, we all know that, but you have to be willing to make a commitment. You have to be willing to be dedicated, and you cannot give up. One of the other individuals in my book, outside of the aviation community, is Mark Victor Hansen. And he wrote a book, and a lot of people are going to know it, Chicken Soup for the Soul, and it's become hugely popular. He went to 140 publishers before he got a small publishing company down in Florida that would agree to publish his book. And then the rest is history. But it's that passion. It's that dedication. It's not giving up. It's that perseverance. And it doesn't have to be a Sully or a Sean or a Julie. We can all do that. We all have that passion within our hearts. We all have that passion within our soul. We all have dreams. And as we kind of go through life, sometimes we just settle. Sometimes we just tend to live a life of mediocrity and a life of complacency. We are meant to live a life of vibrancy. We are meant to live it fully and to go after our dreams and goals. We've got one life to live, and we've got to make the best out of it and go for our dreams and goals, whatever they may be. The key thing here for people to focus on is that no matter what happens, whatever your dreams, whatever your goals, you need to persevere, have dedication, and you will reach them eventually. You may reach a lot of challenges, obstacles in between, but you will reach them in the end. It's just, how bad do you want it? How bad do you want it? And Max T, you know, you're a certified flight instructor. How many students did Max have that wanted to become a pilot? And he started training them. And they said, oh, I don't want to do this, or this is too challenging, or I don't want to learn about weather patterns, or I don't want to learn about ATC communication. And they just gave up and they walked away. Other students that come every week or every 2 weeks, and they're prepared and they'll do whatever it takes to reach their private pilot's license. It's that perseverance. It's that dedication. How bad do you want to reach your dream and goal? But if you really want something, if you really want to reach your dream, your goal, whatever it may be, you will reach it.
Tom, can you tell our listeners where they can get a hold of your book?
Well, my book is available on Amazon, also available on Barnes & Noble and all booksellers. And I also want to mention this, Max. I know that you have listeners that not only listen within the United States, but you've got listeners in Australia. You've got listeners in the UK, all over the world. My book is available worldwide. It's available through booksellers in the UK, available through booksellers in Australia, and all over the world. So wherever your listeners are, they will be able to get a copy of my book.
Okay, great. Tom Curran, thank you very much.
Thank you, Max.
And now here's David Vanderhoof with the airplane of the week.
Thank you, Max. The Mirage 3/5 has a unique history that has spun off many indigenous manufacturing of the aircraft. Most of this occurred because of arms embargoes. The first was the IAI Kefir, which was a Mirage 5, which became the Nesher. The Nesher was built using plans obtained by Israeli spies from Dassault. The Nesher would go on to be powered by the J-79 and become the Kefir. But that's another story. Tonight, we're going to talk about an aircraft that was created out of the lessons learned from the Mirage 3 and the Kefir, the South African Air Force Atlas Cheetah. But why are we doing the Cheetah, you ask? Because it was one of our listeners' favorite aircraft, and Rob Mark's comment was, I don't even have a clue what that is. So it's time to learn up, Mr. Mark. In early 1980s were a dark time for South Africa. They were fighting the border war with Angola. Angola was being supported by Cuba and the Soviet Union. They were being given modern technology like the MiG-23 call sign Flogger by NATO. South Africa was also under sanctions by the United Nations. UN Security Council Resolution 418 imposed a mandatory arms embargo to the nation. For those who don't know, this was part of a group of sanctions because of South Africa's rule of apartheid. For those who might not know, apartheid was a racial segregation that was officially ended, thankfully, in 1994. By the early 1980s, the South African Air Force fleet of Mirage 3s and Mirage F1s were aging. The decision was to modernize the older Mirage 3s. This became known as Project Cushion. The remanufacturing was done by Atlas Aviation, now Daniil Aviation. Using techs from IAI, who worked on the Kafir and the Nesher and the canceled Lavi project, the project began. The airframes were zero-houred. In some cases, up to 50% of the Mirages were replaced. Fixed canards were placed at the leading edge of the intake. Additional stores pylons were added, and the Snecba Altar 9K50C11 was refurbished and upgraded. A new wing and spar were added. The wings were then given a drooping leading edge and a dog's tooth incision. A new computer system was built with built-in redundancy drove new elevons. Strakes were also added to the nose to provide better angle of attack, and new aerodynamics provided a 15% increase in AOA and a reduced landing speed to 100 knots. With all of this came better radar, avionics, and a suite for electronic warfare. For the pilot was a new helmet-mounted sight and an oversized HUD. All of this was designed, note in air quotes, without external help. History will show that the Israeli Defense Forces Air Force contributed to the Cheetah's creation. While it's not proven, they may have been provided some Neshers from the aforementioned Air Force to South Africa for testing. Unveiled to the world on July 16, 1986, the Cheetah D had already been deployed to the 89th Combat Flying School at Petersburg. The first Cheetah D was started in April, 3 years earlier. The Cheetah D was a two-seat trainer with a secondary ground attack mission. The D could deliver later in its life precision-guided munitions. Also, they were created indigenously. Eventually, 16 were built. The aircraft were finally retired in 2008, with three being retained by Daniil Aerodynamics for testing. As an interim aircraft, the Cheetah E was created. The E retained the original ATAR 9C3 engine. They did not have the sophisticated suite of avionics of the C. They were designed for standby interceptor to support the F1s. They were equipped with the V-3B Darter, which was developed from the French Magic R-550. Only 16 E's were ever produced. They continued to serve until the border war ended in 1989 and were mothballed. However, the Chilean Air Force purchased five complete airframes to use as spare parts for their Panteras, which were actually upgraded Mirage 50s. The definitive version of the Cheetah was the C. The Cheetah C featured an updated cockpit with a wide-angle HUD and HOTAS controls, or hand-on throttle and stick. It featured a pulse Doppler multimode radar built by Elta and another Israeli company. The cockpit featured a one-piece wraparound windscreen. The deletion of the wing fences replaced with a dogtooth wing. It could carry a variety of South African-built precision-guided munitions and missiles. Eventually, 36 of the Cheetah Cs were built. The Cheetahs were eventually replaced by the Saab Gripen in 2008. Ironically, the Cheetahs never saw combat in the war they were supposed to fight. So Cheetah versus Flogger battle never occurred. In 2009, Ecuador purchased 10 Cheetah Cs and 2 Ds to replace their Mirage F1s. They are still flying them today and are supplemented, ironically, by Kafirs. Of note, in 1990, when there was a chance when South Africa tasked the Cheetah Cs with the nuclear strike role, replacing their aging Blackburn Buccaneers. South Africa, though, dismantled their 6 nuclear warheads in 1992. So with that, this is David M. Vanderhoof, your AGP historian, signing off.
Thank you, David.
And you guys know when the Cheetah made its first appearance, right?
First appearance?
Yeah, it was in the second Tarzan movie.
Oh, dear.
A very fast but bad joke.
Yes.
One of my favorite movies, 1934.
All right, Max, since you've got the floor at the moment with the worst joke of the episode.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're just back from the Collier Trophy Selection Committee. How did that go?
Wow. You know, I commented to somebody that that was probably one of the most exciting experiences of my life. Yeah, I was invited to be on the committee since I'm one of, president of the Aero Club in Northern California, and there are six Aero Clubs, and typically the presidents of any two of those clubs will be on the committee in any given year. Since we're part of NAA, and NAA is responsible for managing and selecting the winner of the Collier. So it was really quite an honor, and it was great fun. We had, over 30 people who were on the committee, and most of them were from major airframe manufacturers. So just think of any airframe manufacturer, and there was probably somebody on the committee. And we spent most of the day last week listening to presentations, and then discussion and decision, and it was quite fun. So for folks who haven't heard yet, the NASA's Dawn project was selected for the Collier Trophy this year, and that's a deep space exploration project, which was one of the first successful uses in space of the ion engine, which NASA has said is an important technology for getting them to Mars. So this is kind of an inflection point, use of a major technology that's going to give us more milestones in space. So It was great fun, and what can I say? I'm hoping I'll be lucky enough to be invited back sometime.
Was this the first time that you had been on the committee?
It is. Ah. It is. And the fun part was there were several people on the committee that I knew but hadn't seen for a while, and other folks I knew of and got to meet. And so it was just it was great fun all the way around, plus just getting to listen to presentations from all the nine nominees was awesome. Mm-hmm. A lot of really great innovation and work going on in aviation and aerospace. I think this is a very exciting time for our industries, and people should feel good about what's happening out there right now.
Did you come home with a cool T-shirt or something?
I did get a very nice coffee mug.
But what I think is really cool is Jet Propulsion Laboratory won the Collier for an engine, and that's not what they do.
Well, okay. So we should have given it to somebody else?
No. I like the fact that JPL, who hasn't worked on jet engines since the 40s, won a Collier this year for an engine.
Well, I mean, they specifically won it for the Dawn project, which is more than just an engine, but the engine was a pretty exciting part of it.
Brian, have you got something going on in your world lately?
Since the beginning of the year, I've been to New York, West Palm Beach, Houston, Tampa, Newark, St. Louis, and probably a few other flights in between. And I was fortunate enough to get upgraded on two of my segments into Newark. So I flew on the United PS flights, which is the kind of enhanced service. And one of the aircraft I flew on was the traditional PS 757 that had the, I don't know how to describe it, but there are two sections. When you board a 757, you don't board through the door near the cockpit. You board at the door just in front of the wing, and there's a first class or business first section to, if you make a left. And on the PS flights, you have a business first section to the right. So there's kind of two cabins of business first, if you will. Mm-hmm. And when United changed from JFK to Newark, they brought some of their international 757s into the fleet, where there's only the one business first section. So when you make a left, it's business first. When you make a right through the door, you're in economy plus. And I noticed that there was actually a difference in the two aircraft. And the old international aircraft, and I don't know why, maybe you could help out with this, was a lot noisier than the two section 757.
Huh.
So I'm not sure if it was engines or insulation or what, but it was noticeably louder.
I have no idea. I have no explanation. Maybe someone listening can help us with that.
Yeah, maybe some of our listeners would know. It was really interesting. Being in Economy Plus, you actually got a blanket and a pillow, which was kind of nice. As a United 1K flyer, you get free food and a drink, an alcoholic beverage on board. That was really nice. There was actually what felt like a larger seat pitch. So Dan Webb, that's out to you. But one thing that I was really surprised at, the window seats, almost every window seat in Economy Plus was misaligned. And I just find it really strange that you have your supposedly, you know, second best passengers, people not paying for first, you know, your frequent flyers, and the window seats are misaligned, making it kind of the crappiest seats on the plane, except it had larger seat pitch.
And hence the chaos that United is experiencing this week with a potential hostile takeover from some board members. It just never stops with those poor guys at United. I mean, there are a lot of people that try so hard, but they just don't seem to be able to catch a break.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to mention. Half of the flight crew, well, actually three quarters of the flight crews on these PS flights were really, really good. And they were going, I think, above and beyond and in both the business first and in economy. And there was one flight crew that I had that, I don't know, maybe should retire or something. They just didn't have the right attitude. But it was also really interesting. In business first, they've gone back to having printed menus, which was really nice. And the food was actually quite acceptable. And one of the dishes that I had was lamb. And that was kind of surprising. So all in all, in a mostly good experience.
All right. We have to move on to listener mail. We heard from Austin. Austin's writing us from Korea. And it's a great story. Austin says, I've been a listener of the Airplane Geeks podcast since the days of Courtney and Max. I remember when Rob Mark began his first appearances on the podcast, then shortly after saw him on Fox News in 2010 as a news contributor. I also remember hearing the first of David's history segments, and I'm proud to say I not only met David in person, but have developed a friendship with him over the years. Okay, maybe now I'm getting a little too nostalgic, he says, but I also somewhat miss Rob picking on Dan Webb. However, that's okay because who doesn't love Dan? He says, since I started listening to the podcast, the following has happened in my life. Now, we want to talk about people who are passionate about aviation and trying to accomplish some things. Austin says, when I started listening to the podcast, I was a UH-60 Black Hawk crew chief. It's in late 2008. When not performing my duties, I became a commercial multi-engine pilot and CFI. I went to flight school eventually for the Army and became a Black Hawk pilot. Shortly after, I was selected to become a fixed-wing pilot based on my previous certification and hours. I've spent a lifetime in aviation, starting when my dad built and flew the first Glass Air II back in the 1980s. I'm now flying a highly advanced reconnaissance aircraft called the RC-12X. He says, please don't call it a spy plane. People get sensitive about that. He continues, I'm an airplane geek in every sense of the word. I've also had two kids with my wife, Amanda, and thanks to the military, have made four moves since I started listening. So much has happened since I started listening to the podcast, and I feel a special connection to the podcast and its hosts, guests, and listeners. With all that being said, I want to again reaffirm my gratitude and appreciation for your hard work, all of you. So thanks, Austin, for that. I think...
Can I throw one extra little nugget in there?
Okay.
Very quickly, I mean, Austin and I have been talking quite a bit on email this week, and we were talking about that kid that used to be on the show. You know the guy I'm talking about. But what was really funny is Austin sent me a piece of text, and he said, you probably don't remember this, but I sent you this text back in 2010, and we had a conversation about Dan Webb and some of the funny stuff he did. And I said, I don't know. And he sent me this whole conversation that the two of us had. It was very funny, actually, talking about Dan. And I said, Austin, that was 6 years ago. You still have this text on your phone? You do not get out enough. You know, but it was really funny because it did bring back some really great memories of some of the fun we used to have with Dan on the show. But all right, that was it. I just thought I'd share that.
Okay. We heard from several listeners after last week's episode about thrust asymmetry compensating functions on the Boeing 777. You remember that Todd Curtis mentioned that. We're having some discussions offline about just exactly how the system works, and we've had a couple of pilots write to us about it, and Todd's taking a look at it. So we'll have more about that coming up in another episode. We'll talk about, I think, specifically how that function operates, what it does. So look forward to that. And then we heard from Tom. He sent us an article about the use of, well, old American planes, vintage American planes being used against ISIS. Apparently, the U.S.-led coalition is using a couple of OV-10 Broncos. David, these things haven't been used for, I guess, quite a while, at least not in the military, right?
They were used last in combat in Desert Storm, 1991. The Air Force retired them slightly afterwards, and the Marines desperately, reluctantly wanted to keep them, but they were urged by Congress to retire them in 1995. And what really ticks me off about this story is a certain John McCain, Mr. A-10s are everything. If you change the prefix and it says OV-10, he wanted to cut out the whole program. And it was to pay for two airplanes to use for insurgency. And basically, the OV-10 proved what it's been doing since Vietnam, which is for a low-intensity conflict like fighting ISIS, the aircraft that was designed by the Marines to be a forward air controller and a ground attack aircraft and to be based forward is proving itself really capable. Now, the OV-10 G+, as these are being used, have a four-bladed propeller now instead of their old three on their Garrett engines. They have a much updated cockpit in the rear with better electronics than the old OV-10 D+s. But basically, what's old is what's new again. And sometimes you have the right tool. It's just Congress decides that despite what the military wants, it was time to cut it economically, which this is my anti-A-10 argument. The Air Force and the Marines wanted to keep them, and Congress said no. So they're a bunch of hypocrites.
Okay.
Rant over.
Rant over.
Oh, and by the way, I hope to see at least one of these aircraft in a little over a month because they were returned back to NASA, who loaned them out in the first place.
Oh, they came from NASA?
They came from NASA.
What were they doing at NASA, do you know?
NASA has used them as chase airplanes and as short takeoff and landing experimental aircraft, and they used them in the drone program. And if you go back to the last Langley Air Show I did, which was 2012, and listen to some of the recordings, you'll see some of the pictures of the Langley OV-10s.
All right. Very good. All right, and we'll finish off the listener mail. We heard from Bill Berry, who, of course, is NASA's chief historian. And we were talking about why we were talking about why NASA is now kind of making a big commitment to the first A in NASA. And Bill says, on the why now question, you may recall that our administrator, Charlie Bolden, mentioned his commitment to NASA's first A when he was on the show a while back. The administrator's interest isn't the only reason why aeronautics is getting more attention and funding, but it has certainly had an impact. Our aeronautics folks and others have been pushing for some proof of concept vehicles for quite a while, too. Moreover, there's a growing interest inside and outside NASA in improving transportation to make it safer, cheaper, and less environmentally impactful. So the timing was also ripe for this. But any change, especially one that involves additional funding, can take a while. Bill says the ship of state can take a while to steer into a new course. Bill also sent us some information about the X-planes. We had talked about the quiet supersonic technology plane, that concept, but there are actually three others that NASA is looking at. David, you want to tell us what those are?
One's the blended wing body, which is the flying wing. The other one is the quiet electric airplane. And I forget what the fourth one was. Oh, Scepter. Yes, the computer-sized electric plane. So yeah, electric power, multiple tidy little multiple engines and hybrids. We talked about this on our other show a couple days ago. So, but my favorite in this is the ultra efficient hybrid wing body, the HWB. So I like big airplanes with large wings.
Well, that's going to do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank you all for listening. We want to thank also our guest, Thomas Curran, author of Millionaire Legacy. Tom, are there any websites or anything that you'd like to point our listeners to?
The website for the book is millionairelegacy.com. That's millionairelegacy.com. And my personal website is thomaspcurran.com.
Great. And we'll have links to those in the show notes. Let's tell folks where they can find us online. Start with you, David.
I can be found arguing with people on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof, and I can also be found on Friday mornings on the UAV Digest with my guest host, Max Flight, talking about drones.
And Rob Mark, where do people find you?
Any place that has Jetwine in the name. I think that says it all.
Great. Brian Coleman, how do folks get in touch with you?
Best place to get a hold of me is brian@airplanegeeks.com.
And Max Trescott.
Well, the best place is the Palo Alto Airport. Come on out and fly with me. It's fun meeting all the different listeners. But if you want to do it electronically, you can look for me on Facebook or Twitter. All you have to be able to do is spell Max Trescott with a T.
All right. You can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. Also look for me on LinkedIn, as David mentioned, at theuavdigest.com. Also on the PAX X podcast. We just have a new episode out on that. That's PAXXpodcast.com. Also, you can find me hanging out at the Airplane Geeks listener team. There's a lot of activity going on there. If you'd like to learn more about that, just visit us at airplanegeeks.com/team for more information. You can find us at our website, airplanegeeks.com. Show notes at airplanegeeks.com/393. Opening music is by Brother Love. Outro by Bruno Massone. Please join us next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Keep the blue side up.
And thanks for listening.